Hi everyone. How are we today? Nice to see you all. So welcome to this, the first of the Dharma Geeks session for our new annual transmission on the Abhidharma. My name is Edwin Kelly. As if you've been in Vajrayana online and been following the material so far, you will see that along with Kuntum Pamo, I am one of the guides for this program. And so this is my first Dharma Geeks session, and it's happening at this time in the evening in the Americas, because if it were to happen at 10 a.m. New York time, it would be the middle of the night for me because I'm now living in Australia on the East Coast, about 400 kilometers. I'll speak kilometers. I know most people in North America don't know what a kilometer is, but I see a few Canadians here. You'll know what a kilometer is. We're about 400 kilometers south of Sydney. So if you have a map of Australia, think bottom right corner. It's beautiful here. You should come visit someday. Yeah, so welcome. And so, of course, Cortland and Tim, I think, have been doing Dharma Geek sessions. But as you, anybody who knows me knows that I'm not Cortland and I'm not Tim. And in previously in the Ganges Mahamudra, we had a very specific text that Cortland so skillfully went through line by line and expounded the essence of the teachings that were in there. And in this program, we haven't yet introduced the practice guide that Mingda Rinpoche wrote, the text. That we will begin to dive into that in the immersion course that does not begin for a couple of months yet, November. So we're still in the essence, and we're kind of at 30,000 feet for this first month. And next month in the essence, we get a little bit more deeper into the practices. I want to cover today basically what's in the first month, the first module of the Essence Program, which is the Four Noble Truths. And yeah, just expand a little bit on them and give you some sense of how the program is structured in the Essence course, in through the lens of the Four Noble Truths, so that you can see that, you know, this the way we've laid it out, actually, there's method to our madness. And it's not just some sort of random thing that's going on here. Please feel free to write a comment in the chat, say hi to everybody. I know a lot of you already done it. But if you haven't already, let us know where you're coming from. It's lovely to see you all. I see a few faces that I know and a few faces that I probably don't know. But thank you so much for joining us. But let's begin by a little bit of practice so we can just get ourselves here, get settled, be present for what's going on. So find your meditation posture. And just connecting to the present moment experience, whatever is in whatever's in your mind at this moment, preferably begin with the body in some way. It's such a prominent part of this Abhidharma practice, or these practices that come to us through this tradition. Mindfulness or awareness of body, physical sensations. This is where we usually begin. That may include the breath, the breath practices will be quite prominent in our practices that we do during this program. And hopefully, as you progress through the lessons, the sections, you'll gain a greater appreciation of why these practices focus or begin with our body. Interesting thing is, our body is always where we are. What a great place to start. So, whatever sensations you might experience, there might be tension in parts of your body. There might be some emotions in the tummy, the throat. Just allowing your body to relax. We should also take a moment to reflect on our motivation, our reasons for engaging in these practices, so that we may liberate ourselves from the suffering, the conditions that we find ourselves, and then be able to engage in activities that would also assist others to be free from their suffering. One of the easy things to connect to when we sit is where our body touches our chair or cushion. Touch sensation is such a subtle physical experience because gravity holds us on the planet when we sit, when we stand, when we walk. There's always some part of our body that's connected to the earth or the furniture. And wherever that occurs, there's the sensation of touch. It may also occur where other parts of our body rest on our body, like our hands in our lap, on our knees, our arms to the side of our body. Just notice the sensations of touch. Just breathe naturally, gently. If you wish, you can choose to count your breaths. Just simply 1 through 10. If you get lost, just start again at 1. When you get to 10, also just come back to 1. Okay. Yeah, so again, thank you so much for joining me today. And as I mentioned earlier, today I want to look a little more deeply at the Four Noble Truths. I know the first four sessions of the Essence program are now accessible online, and we're only a couple of weeks into the month of September, so maybe you haven't had the opportunity yet to listen to all of Rinpoche's teachings, Khunsong's videos, my reflections, read any material associated. But some of what I'll say is probably, if you have listened to the material, you will already have heard. But I think we should acknowledge, first of all, that these teachings on the Four Noble Truths constitute what in the Vajrayana tradition we understand as the first turning of the wheel, the Buddha's first teachings. And in actual fact, it was the first teachings that he gave after he was awakened. He had spent many years practicing in ascetic practices in India. During that time, he'd practiced with a number of teachers. He had found a few friends who were also doing these practices. And when he first became enlightened, he was a little bit perplexed. He felt that what he had discovered was way beyond most people's capacity to even comprehend. Even if I explain this to people, they won't understand, was essentially what he thought. So he cast his mind around. He had this capacity to for his mind to travel through distance and space and see what was going on. And he found out that some of his teachers, which he wanted to share this with, had passed away. So, but his five companions that he'd been spent quite a bit of time with doing ascetic practices, who had abandoned him because he had decided to eat food again before he became enlightened, before that night under the Bodhi tree, he realized that they were in Sanat, in the deer park. And so he set off to walk from Bodh Gaya. I don't know how long it took him. It's quite a way. To see them. And it's interesting that the story goes that when he walked up to them, they sort of shunned him because they thought he had gone soft and abandoned his ascetic practices. But then on further examination, they realized, ooh, this yogi that we know as Gautam Siddhartha, it looks a little different. Something has happened. So they offered him a seat. He sat down, and then that day he taught about the Four Noble Truths. And as you probably already know, the Four Noble Truths: one, the truth of suffering; two, the truth of the origin of suffering or the cause of suffering; three, the truth of the cessation or the end of suffering; and four, the truth of the path that leads to the end of suffering. And so our first module covers all four of these. And then the second module next month in the Essence course will really focus on the path. It's interesting, I want to add a footnote here. The conventional translation is the Four Noble Truths. But I read a couple of articles when I was studying that said that actually the more accurate translation is the Four Truths of the Noble Ones. The truths aren't noble, but those who understand them are noble, which I thought was a very interesting point. And so within the Buddhist tradition, we take refuge in the Sangha of the Noble Ones. And so what does the Noble One mean, we might ask? And the definition is slightly different in the different traditions, but there is also essentially the same. One becomes noble when one has a glimpse of nirvana or the unconditioned. You've probably heard Mingyur Rinpoche talk about, the direct realization, the painted moon, the moon's reflection in the lake, and then the new moon. So the understanding is that at some point through our practice, we will have a glimpse, the crescent moon, of the ultimate reality, nirvana, the unconditioned. In the Theravada tradition, the Hinayana teachings, that these teachings on the Abhidhamma come from, which is in the Vajrayana tradition, is the path of the Shravakas. This glimpse constitutes the first stage of enlightenment, known as stream entra. And of course, in that tradition, there's these four stages that lead to arahatship. One becomes an arahant. But in the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, the first glimpse is the first bhumi. This experience is characterized as a number of mind moments that irrevocably transform the mind stream of the individual, and certain kleshas, certain afflictive emotions are uprooted at that point, that this process is irreversible, irrevocable. Once you had this glimpse of the unconditioned nirvana, then there's still a long way to go. Of course, Rinpoche talks about the 10 bhumis many times, and in the Shravaka Yana, there's these four stages to become an arahant. But essentially, you're guaranteed to get enlightened within a few lives, basically, once you've had this experience. So these are the truths of the people who have had this experience, the noble Sangha. And we take refuge in this Sangha when we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. That's the characterization in Tibetan language of this noble Sangha, those beings who have had a glimpse of the unconditioned. So these beings who have had this experience understand these four true aspects to be true. Does that make sense? Yeah, interesting. I thought that was a very different way. We talk, noble truths. What makes the truth noble? Well, it's the people who understand them or who realize them. They are the noble ones. That's what makes the truth noble. So the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, dukkha. I've heard it translated as life sucks. It's a colloquial definition of the first noble truth. And we can all relate to it. And there's many sort of ways that we that kind of points to it, the different types of suffering. If you've practiced in at all with Rinpoche, Togar, Joy of Living Level 3, Joy, Path of Liberation, you will understand, particularly this aspect of impermanence, conditioned reality, relative reality. When causes and conditions come together, a result is sure to follow. There's so much language in these teachings that point to this notion of things being compounded and impermanent and changing all the time. And inherent in that dynamic is this sense of dissatisfaction. Just when you got what you want, it disappears. Or you're really chasing after something you really want and it's elusive, you can't get it, right? There's something about this conditioned giant causal matrix we live in that we call samsara that just really doesn't deliver the goods. I have jokingly said that if we could find the creator, we could sue them because it's a defective product. The fascinating thing is that when we get to the second noble truth, we realize that the creator of this suffering is our own mind. So even if we could find the guy that created this or the being that created this and sued them, we'd end up be suing ourselves. I don't know whether we could pay damages to ourselves. But anyway, that's the beauty of these truths is that, and I think that's the one of the mistakes that we most make is that we're always blaming the conditions for our problem, right? It's always something out there that is causing me to suffer. And if I could just fix what's wrong out there, I'd be okay. And the radical notion of these teachings, this path, is that no, what gets fixed is in here, not out there. When you transform your mind's relationship to experience, you transform your world. You're not transforming your world, you're transforming your mind's relationship to your experience. Really fundamental understanding of the teaching of the Dharma lies in that concept. So the cause of suffering, and Mingrabache talks quite a bit in the teachings in this first few weeks about ignorance. And the reflection that I offered in the fourth week, fourth session, I go into it in quite depth, this notion of ignorance and how our misunderstanding of the nature of the ultimate reality of our mind gives rise to the ignorance that is prevalent within our relative reality. And at its core, it is this notion that we reify, concretize, make real the subject and the object. Me and it. Me and it. And the it, this I don't think I there's nothing more important than understanding this. Getting really deeply into the correct view or dispelling the wrong view of the duality of self and other, subject and object, is in my mind the most profound, effective transformation that can take place in your mind. And it is the cause of our suffering. Understanding that is that it is the cause of our suffering, that because we've bifurcated the subject and the object, which is really just the display of our natural luminosity of the mind, understanding that that's that's the cause, that's the fundamental level at where we make the mistake. That's why we're in samsara, because we have separated, we have, rather than seeing this display as just a manifestation of the clarity, radiant, cognizant aspect of our mind, and just leaving it at that, we conceptually make everything that's out there an object, and me the subject, and we've separated that when it's really just a display of the luminous aspect of our mind. And if we, and that's why Mingrabache Rinpoche's teachings to me are so skillful, because there's such an emphasis on awareness, right? Right from the beginning of joy of living, level one, open awareness, and then right through to nature of mind. If you practice nature of mind, there's this notion, it's all, we're all looking, all of the practices are a skillful means for recognizing awareness as it manifests, this knowing cognizant aspect of the mind, with respect to whatever occurs in our hearts and minds. And that's kind of the theme that runs through the entirety of the curriculum of the three levels of joy of living and eight levels of path liberation. So understanding awareness and how our ignorance misperceives what we know and reifies this sense of self and other as the cause of suffering is really, really critically important. I see, Joseph, you put your hand up. Do you want to say something? Have a question? Yeah, unmute yourself.
Yeah, I have a question. So I'm glad that you're talking about the joy of living. So just to share a little bit about my experience, when I found Tergar and Mingyur Rinpoche's joy of living teachings, it was coming directly from the Theravada tradition and working with this, not this material exactly, the Abhidharma, but it was, you know, the emphasis on the Four Noble Truths. So I'm happy to hear you talk about the thread that connects the two, because now, you know, years later, I was happy to hear Mingyur Rinpoche present these teachings, because in my mind, I still sort of separated the two. There was still in my mind sort of like Theravada, Four Noble Truths focus kind of here, and the Tibetan tradition sort of like elaborates much more on different things. The Four Noble Truths are still in the Tibetan tradition, but the emphasis is a bit different. And Mingyur Rinpoche said something that was interesting to me, in that this study, this Abhidharma study in particular, informs Mahamudra practice.
Yes.
Which for me is, it was an exciting prospect, because now I can sort of like sort of fill in what seemed to me be like a gap between this Theravada and this Tibetan tradition. I was wondering if I could hear you say a little more about that.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Great question, Joseph. You know, it's interesting. I first met Mingyur Rinpoche in 1998 at a retreat that he taught with his brother Tsonyi Rinpoche in Litchfield, Connecticut. I had practiced the year before Dzogchen practices with Tsonyi Rinpoche. Mingyur Rinpoche was only like 22 years of age. He was just a lad. And in that retreat, Tsonyi Rinpoche taught the nature of mind teachings, the Dzogchen practice, and Mingyur Rinpoche taught Hinayana. And I too, like you, had spent many years practicing in the Theravada tradition. At the time, I was the executive director of the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. I had spent 6 months in Burma a couple of years before. I had practiced with Chamye Sayadaw, or Sayadaw Ojanika. I had done my first retreat in 1975 in the Vipassana Theravada tradition with an American gentleman who had the same teacher as Goenkaji, a man named Robert Hover. And so I was very steeped in the body scans and the Anapanasati, the breath and the Four Noble Truths. It's actually, I owe a great debt to me, to Chamye Sayadaw, for the methodical teachings I received over that 6 month period I spent in Burma as a monk in 92, 93, whenever it was, because he drip fed me daily these teachings on the Abhidharma. It went in there. And then because I was practicing, God, I don't know how many hours a day it was, we were getting up at 4 o'clock, going to bed at 9, and sitting and walking very, very slowly all day in complete silence. I began to see these teachings manifest in my daily practice as I sat there. So when I first met Mingyur Rinpoche and he taught the four, you know, Hinayana practice, the Four Noble Truths, it was like, same, you know, because I think we can get a conflict between different traditions. You know, it prompted me then to go and do postgraduate studies, Buddhist studies, and, you know, learn what I really got into was the history of the way the teachings had migrated, evolved through various cultures and over the ages and so forth. But to So I can empathize completely with your question. I'm sorry for the digression, but it's an interesting kind of perspective. One of the best explanations of the difference between the Theravada slash Hinayana Savastivada in this case teachings and that of the Dzogchen Mahamudra. One of the best explanations I've ever heard is that these teachings on the Four Noble Truths, the first turning of the wheel, the Abhidhamma, with what we would call the causal vehicle, they really focus on the mechanism of relative reality, our mind body. It's like a complete taxonomy of all mind body experience, organized into lists and matrices and groups. How many ways can we cut the pie? And then through dependent origination, how does it synthesize moment to moment? And what are the elements involved in giving rise to perception and our misperceptions? And how does it all work? And how is karma built into that? How is suffering built into that? How and then with that granular level of understanding of the causal relationships of our experience, we are armed with the capacity to, we're given the key to unlock the perpetuation of the suffering. But it's all the relative reality, it's all causally related, and it's all related to the building blocks of samsara, juxtaposed to Mahamudra Dzogchen. Well, it's interesting. I just one point that came to mind that I think I should reflect upon or speak to before we move on to the Mahamudra, and that is that even consciousness is causally dependent within the Abhidhamma. You can, whatever is known, whatever consciousness involved is in the knowing is conditioned from this perspective of understanding of the Abhidhamma. I'll speak a little bit more to how the Abhidhamma relates to Nirvana, particularly in the Theravada tradition. Maybe I'll come back to that in a bit. But the other side of this equation is the Mahamudra, Dzogchen, and particularly the third turning of the wheel, the Buddha's teachings on Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha, which is considered to be the third turning of the wheel. This notion that we're endowed with Buddha nature, our true nature is inherently good, pure, whole, complete. We are Buddhas at essence. Our essence is the ground of all experience is this purity. That's the Dzogchen kind of take on it. The problem is that we're confused. You know, we've got we things are not, our view is not quite right. It's polluted. It's mistaken. It's erroneous. A really good way is to look at it. There's an error in the way we see our reality. And however, all of the methods that are in the Mahamudra, Dzogchen, Joy of Living, Path Liberation, are all skillful ways for us to recognize the ways in which our Buddha nature manifests, awareness, loving kindness, compassion, wisdom, capabilities. And our practice is to recognize those qualities and to sustain that recognition, particularly the wisdom of the union of clarity and emptiness that is at the core of the definition of the nature of our mind. We are not so focused on the relative. and the causal theme. And actually, I think it's really skillful that we within Turgut now, and Mingo Rinpoche has, wrote this wonderful manual, practice manual, and we now, having been practicing Mahamudra for years, Dzogchen for years, for those of you who are in the path of liberation, I think it's a really skillful pivot to come back and look at the causal vehicle. Because often we can get a concept of what nature of mind is, but what's really going, what's in our face is our afflictive emotions. And they're all causally related, right? It's all interdependent. Of course, the joy of living level three really gets to this on a passionate level. And so what happens is that in the Abhidhamma, the awareness relates to objects. So we're still, it's still dualistic. We've still got me, the being that's aware of the thing that I'm aware of, whether it's this sense door or that sense door or consciousness, objects or appearances in our mind, what we imagine, what we remember, and so on and so forth. There's still a dualistic way to it. And yet, in the Mahamudra way of introducing joy of living, is we have this thing called open awareness, or awareness without support, or objectless awareness, right? I didn't find, well, there are some teachers in the Theravada tradition who do focus more on the knowing quality of the mind. But then when we get introduced to the nature of our mind, we begin to experience this awareness in a non-dual way. And so there's this spectrum of knowing from the dualistic end to the non-dualistic end. And as we develop our nature of mind practice, that needle could be anywhere on any given day. But over time, I think the needle kind of shifts towards the non-dual end of things. But yet, stuff still comes up in any given day. We are triggered because of whatever. And what this Abhidhamma teachings really point to is we get triggered when we cling to the sense of self or other. It's that clinging, that reification, that conceptual overlay that makes this thing out there and me here and poor me is afflicted because that's causing my problem. And that's invariably what triggers our, the desire, the aversion, the jealousy, the pride. All of the afflictive emotions arise because of the primordial ignorance of mistaking the clarity of our mind or bifurcating, separating the clarity of our mind into subject and object. Hope that was helpful. That was a long-winded little spiel, wasn't
Thanks a lot.
Sorry, you got me on my high horse. So, understanding that this dualistic reification of things and self is the cause of suffering, the second noble truth, is really, 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 really important. The third noble truth, the knowledge that there's an end, that we can, that there is a way to end this, or end is possible. I don't think there's much more to say about that other than it's a recognition of the absolute truth. And that's why the nature of mind practices are so powerful, because they really focus on the absolute truth, this Buddha nature, the true nature. But it's really the key to that is the wisdom, the understanding of emptiness, right? The understanding of the union of clarity and emptiness, understanding progressively through the four pointing out instructions how our mind really is, the true nature of our mind, and then being able to recognize that. And the difficulty or the skill involved in that recognition is being able to let go of the conceptual mind that incessantly makes real all that appears in our mind. That's the skill that is acquired through the nature of mind practice, the ability to let go, to not collapse into, have the conceptual mind collapse into a thing and thingify, if that's the right word. Thingify our experience, because that's what we do. You know, I am, it is, fill in the blank. And once you get to I am and it is, and you make that real and cling to it and don't let go of it, and in there lies all of our problem. And so now we're talking the path, the fourth noble truth. And in the Abhidhamma approach of the path, we really introduce this understanding of shamatha and vipassana. And of course, the nature of mind is characterized as the union of shamatha and vipassana. And so, what is shamatha? What is vipassana? We'll explore this significantly. Shamatha and Mingyur Rinpoche, if you attended the weekend retreat we did a month ago, and he really talks to it in the teachings in this module. And I've got a reflection. I'm not sure whether it's in these, is it the third week? Yes, I think the third week I do a reflection where I talk about shamatha and vipassana. If you think about it, what happens that gives rise to our suffering is we get lost in appearance. Tim has, when Tim talks about this, one of the expressions that I've heard him use many times is that we become beguiled by experience. It's nearly like as though we've allowed the experience to seduce us, to hijack us, right? Experience has come along and yanked us. We've reacted to it and we're gone. We're in an afflictive emotional relationship to our experience because we want it, or we don't want it, or we're indifferent to it. And now we're really speaking to the second skanda, aggregate of feeling, of pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant or unpleasant. And we talk in the next module. I don't know which week it is. In the next module, we go through the four foundations of mindfulness clearly, and so the mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of mind, and mindfulness of phenomena will be the next 4 weeks we get to after this module. And so we'll explore in depth this notion of Vedana, the second skanda, feeling. But it's essentially when we are beguiled by something that's pleasant, then the afflictive emotion of desire, greed, attachment arises. When we're beguiled by the afflictive emotion or by something that's unpleasant, the afflictive emotion of aversion, hatred, get out of my face, I don't want you, go away, comes up. And then when it's neither pleasant or unpleasant, then there's an indifference. There's disposition in the mind that meh, I don't care. You know, it's not exciting, or I don't want to fight it. I don't want to run after it. Meh, right? And so these three feelings are really what fuels our afflictive emotions, and it's what creates our karma. And actually, and it's a very specific link in the 12 links of dependent origination, and it is key to our liberation. Understanding this, and Rinpoche talks, so now we're on the path, and Rinpoche talks about awareness is the antidote for greed, attachment. If we, you know, if when we lust after something, if we can just be aware of the feelings of chasing after the pleasant feeling, we can let it go. But we have to be really aware. The mindfulness has to be really strong. Therein lies the antidote to the afflictive emotion, the root poison of desire or greed. When we are faced with something we don't like, the antidote is to open our heart, to accept, to be willing to be with, to ex allow our mind to experience that which is unpleasant. That is the antidote to aversion, to anger, to hatred. And then, of course, when we're dissociating, disconnecting, indifferent to that which is neither pleasant or unpleasant. I speak to the, actually, I speak to this in one of my reflections you'll get to next month. The translation of the Pali Sutras on the Vedana, the second skanda of feeling, always translates it as pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, and neither pleasant or unpleasant. I've never seen it translated as neutral, because I think neutral overlays a conceptual something about that ignorance, that when you say neither pleasant or unpleasant, you're into the third of the four boxes that Mingyur Rinpoche talks about. And there's something about that that's much more connected to the wisdom of emptiness than giving it a concept like neutral. I've had some great back and forth with Michelle Martin about this in some correspondence. And I think it's, Rinpoche talks about wisdom being the antidote to ignorance. And so this notion of things not inherently existing, emptiness of all apparent phenomena, is really, really important to cut through the delusion, the confusion, the ignorance that has got us in this mess in the first place. So, that's the path. And the shamatha allows us to be with our experience. It's kind of translated as calm abiding, shine, in the Tibetan tradition. But, stability, tranquility. Of course, there's this whole area of the jhanas or dhyanas, the concentration. But from my understanding, my teachers, both in the Theravada tradition and in the Vajrayana tradition, it's possible to have a level of stability of the mind that's not necessarily absorbed. And in actual fact, you need to not be absorbed in order to engage in vipassana. The absorptions in the jhanas negates the capacity to investigate or inquire into the nature of our experience, which is so critically important in the Vipassana practice. We need to have our, we can't just bliss out. We need to have that sharp investigative mind engaged in order to be able to understand the true nature of our experience, to have a direct experience of the true nature of the relative and the absolute. And that is Vipassana. But we do need the mind to be stable. If the mind is beguiled, if the mind is carried away, then we are not able to see things truly. We are too wrapped up in, we are too carried away by, to be able to turn on the light of wisdom that comes through Vipassana, if that makes sense. So that's why the path has the shamatha and Vipassana. And of course, the Vipassana here in the Abhidhamma is really about the relative truth. At some point, I said I was going to come back. I just remembered, I promised I'd come back. In the Theravada tradition, there's this amazing piece of literature called the Visuddhimagga, written by a 5th century Indian monk called Buddhaghosa. I've got it on the shelf here somewhere. Maybe it's over here. I've actually read it. But it talks about in the stages of insight within that Theravada Vipassana tradition. And this speaks to what I said earlier about the mind consciousness being conditioned. The way it's characterized in the Theravada tradition is that the mind takes nirvana as an object. And that's what happens in this moment of seeing. In the moment of seeing, that gives rise to the nobility of the mind stream that understands the Four Noble Truths as being true. In the Theravada tradition, Buddha Ghosha explains it as the mind takes nirvana as an object. Now, that's totally contrary to the teachings on Buddha nature that come from Mahamudra and Dzogchen, but it's an interesting point, I think. Yeah. Poof, I've been raving on here. I've exhausted myself, and I would really welcome. We got 10 minutes left. I'd really welcome any comments, any questions. Yes, Joseph again.
So I have another one on the point that you just made. So in other words, the Four Noble Truths arises in the mind stream as a matter of one's meditation experience, not something that one is thinking about necessarily. It just becomes intuitively, this is true based on what you experience about the mind.
Yeah, I think that's true on some level. There's the definitely. So it is said that when the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths to the five companions in Sanat, his first teaching, I can't remember. Some of them experienced stream entry while he spoke. Others got it within a few days or the next day or something. So all of those five first disciples became stream enterers, had direct recognition of the unconditioned from those teachings. So there's definitely a correlation between hearing it as a teaching and experiencing it as in one's mind stream. And then knowing it as a truth, right? And I mean, I think that's true for all these teachings. And it could really be sort of said is, you know, are the teachings, the view as taught conceptually, leading one to the understanding that arises through our experience? I certainly felt that when I was practicing in Burma years ago. Chamya Sayadaw would teach on the five aggregates and six sense doors and dependent origination. And then I'd go back to the cushion and I'd have experience that just completely affirmed what he said. But his teaching conceptually was a very different reality to my direct experience of it. Should I? Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. And the transformation of the mind. The insight, the wisdom that arises in the mind definitely the primacy of that is through the experience, not the conceptual understanding. And that's why it's deemed to be irrevocable, because once it's happened in your mind stream, you can't unlearn it, if that makes sense, right? Yeah. Micah, is that how I say it?
Yes. All right. Am I unmuted?
Yes,
Yeah.
you are. We can hear you.
All right. Cool. Yeah. So I was gonna ask, following on what you were saying, I think what we're talking about is so would you say then that enlightenment or nirvana isn't an extreme? And
Isn't.
is an extreme. It's part of our conceptual framework when we talk about.
Extreme.
And I'm thinking about the supplication to the one of the lines in the supplication to the
Dr. Kogan.
Akpo Kagyu. May I recognize the inseparability of
Yes.
samsara and nirvana?
Yes. Really, really, the most important line in that supplication, in my mind. Yes.
All right.
I wouldn't call it an extreme. I say there are two ways of looking at reality. One is relative and one is absolute. And it's easy for us to conflate the two. And I think we can use some conceptual understanding of the absolute to overrule the law of karma in the relative. I think while ever we're in this body, while ever we embody the five skandhas, the five aggregates, we will be subject to the causal reality of relative reality, samsara, life, everything, the environment, the planet, yeah, everything. However, the ground of all of this is unconditioned. This is only possible because, at its essence, the absolute reality is the union of clarity and emptiness, this consciousness, this knowing, this clarity, this radiance of knowing permeates everything, but it's empty in essence. And in that union, infinite possibility is present, and it manifests as what we see, right? And so when we say, can we realize, may I realize the inseparability of this? It's not that nirvana is separate from samsara. It's samsara is possible because nirvana is the reality, the absolute reality. And it's not, and if you have the absolute reality, then, which is defined as the union of clarity and emptiness, then this will appear. But it will be infused with suffering if we don't see the truth of it. Because if we collapse into the ignorance of a subject and object, if we make real the duality, the separate, we foster separation. And in that separation is suffering. But if we realize that this separation is a delusion, it's erroneous, and then we will be free from the suffering embedded in this display.
It seems like to switch over to the Ganges Mahamudra, the line in there, if free of all wishes, you do not dwell in extremes. It almost seems like that's speaking to that non-conceptual state that where we're in open awareness. But also it's if free of all wishes, you do not dwell in extremes. It's like in this relative reality, how do we get from point A to point B without engaging the conceptual apparatus? So is it like it's not a, it's like how do you kind of sustain?
Well, that's the beauty of the path liberation. Levels 3 and 4 really address that question you're talking about. How can I see the nature of mind while engaged in the display? That's path liberation, level 3 and 4. And so it's possible. But then, a lot of tasks we do, try doing a spreadsheet while resting in the nature of mind. Try writing a law brief while resting in the nature of mind. Try fixing a motor car while resting in the nature of mind. When it comes down to the causal reality, we need to engage our conceptual mind because that's how it works. But are we attached? Are we clinging? To outcomes, are we making it real? Are we making it solid? Are we invested in this being the way we want it to be or perceive it to be? That's where our suffering lies.
Thank you.
I mean, even Rinpoche talked about there are good concepts, like that, the thing, that classic Zen koan or statement of the finger pointing to the moon, right? There's the painted moon, there's the reflection of the moon, there's the moon in the sky, the conceptual minds that are part of, Rinpoche employs concepts very skillfully in his teachings of nature of mind. because we, the mind has, and that's what Vipassana is. Vipassana, all these questions we're given to ask in Vipassana practice are all skillful conceptual ways of examining our reality so that we can find the key to unlock the suffering.
And I've heard him say that there's always a little bit of conceptual mind that yeah. it's never yeah. complete a blank yeah. slate.
Yes, no, it's very helpful to know when you step off the curb and there's a bus coming that it's just empty in essence, it'll be fine. No, it's good to know that the bus is solid, because if it hits you, you'll know it. Hey, they say in car talk, you've wasted a perfectly good hour. We've come to the top of the hour. All conditioned things are impermanent. That's what the Buddha said. And here we are. We've spent a whole hour having a wonderful and delightful discussion. I want to thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun. We hope, you know, I'm doing one of these every month through this transmission, so that'll be fun. And I don't know, I think every other month I'm also doing the heart-to-hearts. I'm still trying to get into the swing of things. I rebelled and said I'm not going to do any more midnight sessions. They're detrimental to my sense of well-being. So we will do them at this time. But thank you so much. Maybe we could just take a little moment to rest, reflect, dedicate the merit. Yeah. Take a little moment to reflect on our time together. And may whatever benefit has arisen from our discussion, our understanding of the Four Noble Truths and the ways, particularly the ways in which we cause our suffering, and the wisdom that comes from understanding this, and how we can let go of our ignorance, uproot the ignorance of creating our dualistic reality, and just rest naturally in how things truly are. May any benefit that's come from this lead to the welfare and happiness of all beings. May they quickly realize the nature of their mind. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Enjoy your day. So there was some question in the chat I saw about it. This was recorded and will be available to review on in the program. So thank you so much. Be well. Enjoy your evening. See you
thank
next
you,
time.
Edwin.
Thank
you,
Edwin.
Everybody.
Thanks, bye. Everyone.
Yeah.
Thank welcome. You so much.
Thank you. Obrigada.
Bye bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye bye.
Thank you.